Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome into the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for the first hour. This is a special weekend edition because, well, it's Super Bowl weekend and I'm a 49ers fan, so pretty big weekend for me. Don't be expecting too many responses to emails on Sunday, but I will be back at it on Monday. I will be throughout this show talking about a lot of resource companies, or well, a lot of resources in general, especially the precious metals, and an important update from Great Bear Resources at the end of the show. To kick off the show, though, I am chatting with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex. Now, Mark, the first thing that we're going to talk about here is the treasury market. Bonds have gotten a pretty substantial buy throughout this month to kick off the year. The 10-year entered the year almost at 2% and is down now, closing in on breaking below 1.5%. The argument can be that, you know, this is a fear trade because of the black swan events from this month, but I think there's a lot more going on here. First and foremost, break down what you think is important to note regarding the bond market and yields that are falling quite quickly.
Yeah, what a move, huh? In the last 2 weeks, we're down about almost 29-30 basis points on the 10-year yield. And the 30-year bond yield in the U.S., we dipped below 2% for the first time in several months. And 2% is just an incredible level because that's also the Fed's inflation target. And so if you assume the Fed's going to reach its inflation target on average over the next 30 years, and that puts the real rate on the 30-year below zero, this is a credible move. I suspect that we've gone a bit too far here. I've been bullish on bonds, even though a lot of people thought we'd head higher in yields. And I was looking for this correction in the stock market, as we've had, I think. But it's still quite violent. I think the market's happened too quickly, and I would be surprised. China returns early next week, and once we get their markets come back and we check on how that new coronavirus is doing, I think that the markets could stabilize. And that is to say, the market seems to me to be pricing in the worst developments, and as the developments actually transpire, I think we could see a reversal of some of these dramatic moves.
So, Mark, if you think the markets are pricing in the worst of what could come out of China next week when those markets reopen, let's break down what you think the possibility is to see, A, the market reaction out of China, also the implications of what it means that the markets have been closed so long, and, well, the only insights we have is what's been going on with that offshore yuan, which has fallen a fair bit during this whole coronavirus scare. Please take us through some of the nuances and important factors that you're paying attention to.
Yeah, sure. So we do know a few things. You're right. You know, the Chinese market, the mainland market, closed on January 23rd. And since then, we know how different markets have reacted. So, for example, in the Asia Pacific, the MSCI Asia Pacific Index, down about 3.5%. But some of the markets close to China, like Hong Kong and Taiwan, were down about 5%. In the past 2 weeks, the U.S. is only down about 3.2%. Kind of ironic because this past week alone, that's what European markets were down. China's been successful in developing an offshore market for its currency. That offshore RMB lost about 1%, a little bit less than 1%. So if the onshore yuan opens up, possible that that would put the dollar close to that 7.0 level. Remember when we went above there back in August last year, the U.S. accused China of manipulating their currency. This time it's a bit different. Also, looking at this 10-year bond yield, it's trading right around 3%, down about 20 basis points in the past month or so before they close for the holidays. But so we should expect lower yields in China as well. Growth, the early estimates suggest that maybe growth goes from 6% to about 4.5%. Now, the trick, though, I think, is that even though China officially reopens on Sunday, the 2nd, that many of the states, many provinces, about 12 or 14 provinces will remain closed, including a couple of large cities. And so what this means then, those the places that are still going to be closed are going to, they account for about two-thirds of the GDP and about three-quarters of the China's exports. The very important point is to say, even though China is going to reopen, the disruption to the supply chains and the economic impact will still be on the downside. That is, the supply chains will still be disrupted. I think you got a company like Starbucks closing down about half of their branches in China, and it's going to be extended. The close is going to be extended longer than the official dates. So supply chain disruption. So bottom line here is a headwind to the global economy. Looks like it's going to be more serious than previously anticipated, and more serious than, say, the last coronavirus like SARS.
So then, Mark, what about the moves into these safe haven assets? If you think that the broad markets are already pricing in almost the worst case scenario, do you think that means that these safe havens have run too much in this short term rally?
Well, I think that partly what happened is that going into this crisis, this coronavirus crisis, if you will, that the market was leaning very heavily the opposite way. Long equities, long risk, long emerging markets, short fixed income. You know, many people are getting more bearish on yields. People are talking about like European yields. Like, for example, the German Bund fell, the yield rose to minus 20 basis points. And people are talking about it going above zero. And instead, we're at minus 40 basis points now. So I think that what makes this dramatic move is not just the unexpectedness of the coronavirus. I wouldn't want to call it a black swan, because this is the third virus of this kind we've had since 2003. So 15 years, one every 5 years almost on average, it seems. So I don't think it's a black swan, but I think that what makes the dramatic response is that the market was just positioned wrong for it. So risk had to come off. And you know, a lot of the equity markets, we had talked about this before, a lot of this seemed to be exaggerated to the upside. Equities were too high valuation-wise. They needed some kind of pullback, and this is really just a trigger for it. So I think both the virus unexpected, but market leaning the wrong way, makes both of these things together, makes this Molotov cocktail, if you will.
Which is what some people are at least pointing to, why these markets are finally pulling back, because a lot of people were expecting the markets to pull back. Let's also address central banks over the last couple weeks. This week we had the Fed that didn't really surprise anybody with any comments, but I think there were some takeaways where they again are reiterating that they're okay with seeing inflation go over 2%. They're saying that's not a ceiling for what they would like to see. And they're also saying that it sounds like this balance sheet expansion, while they may tone down some of their actions in the repo market and potentially end them by April, they're not going to start unwinding that balance sheet again. What was your takeaway from some of the central bank news this week?
Yes, I think that what happened really is that the major central banks are really out of the equation. That is, we shouldn't expect a change in the next month or two. And the important thing to keep in mind as you think about what's going to happen in February is that none of the major central banks meet. The ECB doesn't meet till March. The Fed doesn't meet till March. Bank of England, Bank of Japan don't meet till March. Now, there are a couple of exceptions. Next week, we have one of them is the Reserve Bank of Australia. But after the unemployment rate fell for 2 months in a row, slightly firmer than expected CPI, they're not expected to do anything either. And what this means with the central banks standing pat on current policy positions is that next week's PMIs won't really matter so much, because before the central banks meet again, we're going to get a new batch of PMI data. So I think that the effect of one of the effects of the central banks is that they're taken out of the equation. That is, we shouldn't expect any change in any of the major central banks in the next month or two. And that is to say February, no central banks are meeting, so March and April. And then maybe by Q2, we'll begin getting people, getting the central banks back into focus. But this will take some of the sting away from the economic data.
Okay. Now, how about some other impacts or other news events coming next week besides just the China markets being open?
Yes. Yeah, so in the U.S., we have a couple of political events, the Iowa caucus. the predicted.org website is showing that Bernie Sanders continues to lead there, as well as the next primary in New Hampshire. I don't think it's going to have much of a market impact, because it is, as expected, but also that I think people, there's no doubt that it's still a relatively fluid situation on the Democratic side. And most of the economic models and the websites like predicted.org are really, they're really consistently predicting that Trump will be reelected. So what happens on the Democrat side, probably more noise and sort of more inside baseball type of story than a real market mover. The following day, we get the State of the Union by President Trump, and that's going to be, it's usually just another thing more to domestic audience, of course. What's going to be important about this one is that ahead of the November election, the White House and the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin have been promising to unveil middle-class tax cuts. And so we could be seeing this play out, be expressed, formally unveiled in the State of the Union address early next week. But probably the most important of the economic data that comes out next week will be the U.S. jobs data. And this is one of those cyclical indicators for me that we peaked the 12-month moving average, used to smooth out some of the noise of fluctuations, that peaked in 2016. So I think that we should be, gradually, but surely, the job growth in the U.S. is slowing. I think we'll get another subdued report, call it the mid-150s, 150,000 or so non-farm payrolls. We'll have earnings. We've had several states, not quite half of the states, raise minimum wage, and that should help put earnings year-over-year rate back above 3%, with a dip below at the end of last year. So the employment data in the U.S., Canada also reports employment data. Canada's employment data has been all over the board, even though they created about 50% more jobs in 2019 than 2018. The number of full-time positions didn't really change. It's a volatile series. And I think that as long as it's not a very strong number, I think that they'll keep people like myself thinking that the Bank of Canada will have to cut rates somewhere in Q2.
Okay, so now just taking this all into context for your general strategy or thoughts on these markets, what do you think? U.S. equity markets, do you think this downtrend continues? Do you think safe havens continue to get a buy? Or on the flip side, do you think this is all maybe run its course and we go back into these ranges that all of these markets had been trading in? I guess except for the U.S. market that just kept on heading higher and higher almost every day.
Yeah, I thought I had a pretty good guess as where we had stopped this week. It was almost the 38.2% retracement of the rally, the leg up since early December. But we're going to finish probably below there in the U.S., trading heavily. So I do think that the market's going to get overshoot on this side. And that's what I want to do. I just want to see some sign. Maybe it'd be like a one-day reversal pattern where the S&P 500 makes a new low and then closes near its high, like it did on the WHO, the World Health Organization's announcement. It looked like that was on Thursday, and the stock market had a nice recovery, but there wasn't any follow-through. So I think that's what we want, some kind of reversal pattern with a little bit of follow-through to indicate that a low is indeed in place. But I think broadly speaking, I'd be looking at the currency markets, the Canadian dollar and the Mexican peso, who have been beaten up a little bit in the past week or two. And I think that those currencies, not so much that the fundamentals and USMCA and the high interest rates in Mexico will prevent a sell-off. It's more that this will help lay the grounds for a quick recovery. I think the same thing in the Canadian dollar. The fundamentals generally still seem okay. Currency really got hit hard. And I think that both currencies, Mexican peso and the Canadian dollar, bounce back on the first sign of relief from this anxiety. And that means that the currencies like the Japanese yen and the Swiss franc would suffer as soon as we get some sign that we're past the worst.
All right, Mark, it's always great having you on the show, especially at the end of the week. I find it interesting to recap what happened this week and then look ahead to some of the news events that could drive markets in next week and even throughout in the next couple weeks. Mark, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking time on this weekend. Have a great rest of your weekend and enjoy the Super Bowl.
Good luck, everybody. Go Chiefs.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed that first more general market commentary from who's one of my favorite guests on the show, Mark Chandler. I am now chatting with, I know, listeners or a lot of listeners' favorites, Richard Postma, a.k.a. Doc. And Doc, I wanted to just have you on this weekend show for a general recap on where you see some of the precious metals moving, and we might even get into a stock or two. Let's start off with gold. Gold continues to trade in a higher range. It seems like it still is a lot supported by this general fear trade. At the beginning of the year, it was fear of war. Now it's this fear of the coronavirus outbreak. Either way, gold does keep on moving higher and setting up higher ranges in kind of a stair-stepping manner, something that you and I have talked about. Please give us your updated thoughts on the gold price and the chart, please.
The gold price, it looks good here. It's going to end the month bumping its head right up against the upper Bollinger Band and the monthly chart, and that's a pretty nice-looking chart pattern. But the other chart pattern I love is the MACD on the monthly. And I always favor longer-term months. Monthly is the best than weekly. I don't like the daily charts. That's just a lot of noise to me. Prices moving up and down. They don't really tell you anything about trends. But the monthly chart really looks nice for gold. The only thing that is really a little bit of downer for people is the fact that the gold stocks are, and the precious metal stocks are not keeping up with the pricing. And that's the thing that's really disconcerting, Corey. But I mentioned quite a while back that I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see real movement in those a lot of these stocks, especially the smaller ones, the juniors, until we get much higher in prices. And that's too bad because we had that big rally in 2015 and 16, and we might not take that out yet for a little bit of time, and then we could get up to 1900 and pause for a while. But we're heading up toward 1900 over time, and the gold chart continues to be really solid at this time.
So, Doug, we have talked, it feels like nonstop for the last 6 months maybe, about how the shares have lagged gold. And I've gotten a number of different opinions on what it's going to take for these shares to catch up. Some say, you know what, maybe a little bit more of a correction. Some people look to a more general U.S. market collapse. I do not subscribe to that one because, quite frankly, stocks are stocks, and juniors especially are still considered risky stocks. So I think we do need some stability in terms of a broad financial market as well. Other people have pointed to simply just a breakout of the gold price, maybe moving to 1700 or even getting back up to 1900. And that's what finally drags these stocks along. What do you think it is going to take for the juniors to move up and follow the gold price?
Well, I think, you know, you have your explorers, which I think are going to be the last ones to benefit from this, unless they have some really high grade discoveries. Other than that, I think they're going to be pretty much moribund for a long time. I think the interest is, especially as more people get into this market, will be into the larger cap and also the mid-tiers, especially mid-tiers that look like they have a portfolio and reserves that could drive them into the large tier positions or large capitalization positions. And there are some companies like that, and especially if they continue to have great free cash flow, and they can put that free cash flow to work as far as further exploration that continues to increase their reserve positions, or if they can buy some other companies on the cheap that really complement their portfolio. But I just feel that a lot of these explorers, if they don't have any good-looking drill results, they're going to go nowhere for a long time until we get to the blowout phase someday in this gold market.
Yeah, and that blowout phase still might be a ways away, maybe multiple years away, which is fine because there are these good quality juniors that do continue to run, and still a lot of the majors and even mid-tier producers, I've noticed a lot more attention going back into those, which makes sense because they're generating better numbers, they're going to be able to build up cash positions, and probably, I think, spur more M&A activity coming into the sector. Doc, let's look at GDX as well, because this chart, yes, it hasn't broken out from its highs from last year, but on the weekly chart, monthly chart, still trading very close to, if not at, the upper Bollinger Band. Really looks like it has set up a higher trading range here. How encouraged, or what are your thoughts on this GDX chart, please?
Yeah, GDX is in a decent position, but as I mentioned in the first part of the month of January, I thought the second month we wouldn't be doing much, or even into February, and I'll stick with that position pretty much. I think these stocks are going to struggle for a while. In March, we might get a little bit of bump, but I wouldn't be surprised, especially from looking at the intermediate cycles. I wouldn't be surprised if we don't have to wait a while, unless the gold price explodes on us and continues to just move upward. But we could have a little retraction in the month of February in the gold price, because we've had a couple of months of closing higher. And if that's the case, I think February isn't going to be much. March may respond a little bit, but we might have to wait until later in the spring, as I've mentioned before, for GDX and GDXJ really to break out over their previous highs. Because as I mentioned, we're in an intermediate cycle where it looks like we might be in a little bit of a left translation. So that tells me that we may move sideways to down here a little bit, but not tremendously. And we're just waiting in GDX and GDXJ for some of the moving averages to catch up with these prices. And that happens because when you have a nice move like you did in GDX and GDXJ back in the summer of last year, and then we hit a high around September, and then we've come off that. It takes time for these technicals to catch up. But once again, that's a very healthy bull market when you have that sort of thing. And we've talked about that stair-step procedure and process. And so we're still in that, Corey.
All right, Doc, you talked about some of those moving averages, too. You and I follow the 50 exponential moving average and simple on both the daily, weekly, and monthly. Also, the 200 on the daily, weekly, and monthly. Do you think that some of these markets, whether it's gold or GDX, actually come back and test these moving averages, or is it more of giving them time to catch up to current price levels?
Well, I think GDX, GDXJ could even turn down a little bit, especially to try to move back down toward those 50s, Corey. That's very much, but I don't see them moving down a lot here. It's going to be a combination of still just trading kind of sideways. And we've watched that with GDX for weeks here already. And I think that's to continue, but it gives that 50 chance to catch up. And then we might have a little bit toward that 50. But I think the 50s are the ones that are the ones to watch first, because if they hold, then we move higher from there. But if they break a little bit, then we're going to have to wait for the 200 to catch up a little bit more to these prices.
All right, quick comment just on silver, too. Silver is trading in a very similar pattern as GDX, I think. It's been a bit choppy throughout this month, but seems to be setting up a higher range. What's your assessment of silver real quick here, Doc?
Yeah, silver is really discouraging for a lot of people. Silver has not kept up with gold again, and gold continues to bump its head on the upper Bollinger Bands, but silver is just really kind of depressing for a lot of people because it just does not seem to want to correlate with gold at all. But that's okay because I think silver, still we're in a good position in silver, and I think we're going to trade down to sideways with silver for into February. In March, once again might get a little bump, but silver's just biding its time, and it's letting those moving averages catch up again, and that's a positive thing. And silver is really in a trading range too, it's going to stay in that, it looks like, for a good period of time yet, through February and March, and maybe into later part of the year or spring.
All right, Doc, let's get into one stock here that you and I were chatting about off mic that has been running nicely this year and even at the second half of last year. Really, the fourth quarter of last year started to make some nice moves. I think it's been driven a lot by some good news events as well, as the company has developed their main project. We're talking about Skeena Resources, traded on the Venture Exchange under the symbol SKE. As we're recording this, Skeena has broken above $1 a share on some strong volume. Please, Doc, take us through your position in Skeena and where you think it could go.
Yeah, Corey, I've owned Skeena since months ago. I bought it at 32 cents, and it's really had a nice move. In fact, I added to it a little bit a while back. And technically, it's right now consolidating. The chart looks excellent. And what I really love about this chart is the fact that on the monthly chart, it's broken out above its 50 exponential and 50 simple moving averages. And the ADX strength indicators are very strong. So it could move back here a little bit next month. But it looks like it wants to go higher over time here now.
All right, Doc, we're going to wrap it up there. Always interesting chatting with you. And I know that a lot of our listeners always like hearing your updates on the metals. You are staying consistent to what you have been calling for. But I think even the metals have, in a way, outperformed some of the early expectations that a lot of people have had. Doc, great chatting with you. Have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Cortland Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing on with the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in this segment, with a even more dedicated focus on the resource sector, not just on the precious metals or gold and silver, as I did with Doc in the last segment. I am chatting with Sean Broderick. He is an analyst over at Weiss Ratings. Now, Sean, let's talk about gold, and I want a more big picture view from you in terms of what the major drivers are going to be for this precious metal. Over this whole month, there's been geopolitical events that have driven moves in the metals, especially in gold. But these geopolitical things are so short-lived and I think cloud the more long-term picture between what drivers you see, either up or down, for the precious metal here. What do you think? What are some of the main factors that you think longer-term investors need to focus on when investing, or really just deciding to invest in gold?
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think people who are purchasing gold because the coronavirus is now raging, you know, they're buying it for the wrong reasons. I mean, as far as we know, gold doesn't cure some kind of viral contagion, so that's the wrong reason to buy it. But as you said, it clouds the bigger picture, and the bigger picture is that the central banks of the world are going to print money from here to kingdom come. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office said Tuesday that America's national deficit and debt are both surging. They expect the deficit to rise above $1 trillion in 2020, and debt held by the public is projected to reach 98% of GDP by 2030. That is printing to infinity. And if you create more paper currency, in this case it's electronic currency, but it's the same thing. You know, I mean, that tends to make the value of real assets get much stronger because you need more paper currency to buy those real assets. So I think that's the big story in gold, that and the old supply-demand thing. I mean, we are kind of reaching the end of the rope for easy-to-find high-grade deposits. They can find more deposits, but they're the stuff they used to drive over in order to get to the richer stuff that they mined out now. So, you know, it's going to be more expensive to mine, even if you're using robots, which is a big change that is coming into the area. So supply and demand, just money creation by the central banks around the world as they try to paper over all the problems in the world. These are the things people should be looking at. I think these are big long-term trends. And so you don't have to chase anything, but I think that you can definitely buy the pullbacks.
Okay, yeah, and I think central bank policy is crucial here, and even the Fed policy, that seems to be one of the biggest drivers, at least recently. And just look what it took for gold to finally break out of that 6 to 7 year range that it was in, was the Fed actually starting to cut rates and then even starting to expand its balance sheet. It hadn't done that for a number of years, and I think that's one of the things that has really sparked this fire under gold and caused it to finally break out above that just short of 1400 level, and now even set up a higher trading range. But then when we dive into the stocks here, it seems like the majors and the miners are doing well. Royalty and streaming companies were shooting up even before the breakout in gold happened, but the money hasn't really flown down to juniors in a broad sense. If you're selective, you can still do very well, but how are you playing the stocks? Because I know you're not just focused on simply the metal here.
No, that is another good point you're raising, which basically boils down to the miners as a group are underperforming what's happening in the metals. I think many people believe that this rally is short term. They expect that, well, they're already working on some kind of vaccine for the coronavirus. So, you know, that'll be rolling out in the next few months probably. So people see the rally in gold as short term. So we are seeing the most miners not perform as well. That said, individual names are doing quite well. I mean, we have a DRD Gold in Supercycle Investor, for example, and that one's up nicely. I don't know if you know about what that company does, but basically it has all the old tailing piles in like South Africa to work with. It doesn't run actual mines. It just reprocesses those old tailings and so can do that rather cheaply. And as the price of like gold goes higher, you know, things get better and get looking better and better for that company. Other ones we have in like gold and silver trader, you know, some are just very strongly. So you have to think, Sandstorm Gold, since you mentioned one of the streamers, you know, that thing's been on a tear. And so I think individual names can help you out quite a bit. You just have to be really selective. And it's not just producers, by the way. Explorers can do well. One reason that you might want to look at explorers is that as a group, of course, we're always talking about things as a group, but as a group, explorers haven't really participated in the rally yet. And so when the next big rally in gold comes, presumably, explorers could do extraordinarily well. I just profiled one on wealthwave.com, that's wealth-wave.com, which is called Core Mining, and that's exploring out in California, has some projects that the big mining companies didn't know what to do with, and it has a great team, and, you know, it's up strongly today. And so, again, I think individual names are the way to go in this area right now, because I expect we'll see a pullback in gold, and miners will probably feel the worst of that. But you know that next move higher is coming. So if you are positioned in those companies that, you know, have very strong fundamentals and are just really leveraged to that next move, I think that's a real winning move to make.
So when you say leverage to that next move in gold, does that mean you're looking at deposits that might be considered marginal right now, or deposits that are trying to be expanded? How do you see a project or a company being leveraged to gold? Because in all fairness, I feel like almost every gold explorer seems to say that they're leveraged to the gold price.
Right. Well, that's actually a great question. Those companies that are those producers, I should say, that are marginally profitable now, those will probably see the biggest boost, because as the price of gold goes higher, you know, then they suddenly start to look much, much better. They're only barely making it right now. Suddenly they have big fat profits rolling in. They'll look great. Those companies with exploration upside, and this is where the explorers can really, you can really play to their strengths. You know, I mean, if you know that they're doing some drilling, working on some stuff, maybe they're drilling out a piece of land right next to the deposit they already know about, because the point's going to come when the big miners want to add more ounces in the ground, because they haven't been doing the exploration, and the way that they do it now, as I'm sure you know, they buy those explorers and the small producers with real blue sky on their deposits. And so look for that. I mean, Silvercrest, for example, that's one we own. That's in gold and silver trader. And an interesting thing just came out, by the way. Kitco handed out its award for the best mining CEO. And number one was Keith Neumeyer of First Majestic Silver, which we also haven't known. But number two was Eric Fear of Silvercrest, because the stuff that company is finding is just extraordinary. They had an initial estimate, but they're doing more drilling, and the drilling's coming back at higher grades than the initial estimate, and just a richer deposit generally. So look for that kind of thing. I think those companies, let's call it upside surprise, those companies that hold the potential for an upside surprise. Once the gold fever really starts, we're in a bull market again, I believe, but we don't have gold fever yet. Once the gold fever really starts, you're going to see these companies with upside surprise potential, I think, do extraordinarily well.
All right, Sean, I also want to talk about a couple other precious metals that I don't discuss all that much, but have been running. One that comes up a fair bit more on our site is palladium. That one has been moving nicely. It's over $2,000 at about $2,200 to $2,300 right now, and that has been moving aggressively higher without many pullbacks in the last couple of years. Also, rhodium's up almost at $10,000. That's been a very aggressive move. I feel like there's a little bit more interest in palladium rather than rhodium, but what's your thought on some of these other precious metals that just have been screaming higher?
Well, yes, and if we're going to talk about the palladium rally, let's just take a brief pause to feel pity for the car companies, because the rally in palladium last year cost the world's car companies $18 billion. You know, they need it. They absolutely need it for the catalytic converters. They could engineer things, but it hasn't hit the price yet where it's painful enough that they want to do something else. They could use silver, for that matter, if they really wanted to. But again, that's a massive engineering undertaking, and they aren't going to do it yet. Now, there is a supply-demand gap in palladium. It's lasted for 8 years. This year, we're probably going to see it fall short again. And normally the gap is just made up by Russia. They have the world's largest palladium supplier there, and it has a huge stockpile, or supposedly it has one. And normally they cover the gap, but they haven't this year. I mean, in November, the company said it would release 300,000 to 500,000 ounces from a supply in the midterm, but gave no definition of what midterm means. I think that scares a lot of people. They don't know when Norilsk Nickel is actually going to push forward with that palladium. When it happens, by the way, that's probably going to be the next big correction in palladium. But if you're looking at the longer-term supply-demand picture, that's a, you know, that's a dip you want to buy, because really the world's car companies do not want to go through the tremendous engineering effort they would have to do in order to make catalytic converters out of something else. They do not want to do that. And so that means that this supply-demand squeeze should continue on. One thing that held the price of the metal back last year, by the way, and like you're probably looking at a chart saying that price wasn't held back at all. Well, it actually could have been a lot worse, except car sales tanked in China. So that actually meant that the price of palladium didn't run nearly as much as it could have, but car sales are cyclical, and coronavirus or not, car sales are probably going to go up in China this year. Probably not this month, but you know what I mean? Over the course of the year, car sales are expected to really ramp up in China, and that's going to put upward pressure on the price of palladium. So, you know, it is playable. I would wait for a pullback. At some point, Russia will release more palladium into the market. That'll be the pullback. That's the pullback you can buy. I'm not chasing anything in this market. But yes, it's a very interesting metal to watch right now.
Absolutely. One other metal that has, well, taken it on the chin, I think a lot due to these geopolitical issues or, well, black swan events this month, has been copper. Copper was trending up above $2.80, and just in the last couple weeks, maybe even just a week, dropped the whole way down to about the 255 region. Are you seeing an opportunity here? And even longer, in a longer term sense, copper is still very much just range bound below about $3 down to about 250.
Yeah, I see an opportunity here. We have one copper pick and Supercycle investor that's working out quite well. It's an explorer, though. A producer might be really hard pressed by what's going on in copper now, with a dip down to 252, prices we haven't seen in many, many months. But on the bright side, this is near the bottom of its range, and most of its hysteria having to do with the coronavirus, and some people may bristle at that. Some people may think that the coronavirus is like really going to get much worse. And so apparently some of those people are copper traders, because they're thinking the way China's the way copper is priced now, it's being priced as if China's going to shut down. China's not going to shut down. And so I see this as a real sentiment driven move. And so I expect that once this starts to rally, that rally could be fast. So I'm looking for the next turn in copper, and I will buy that turn.
All right. Well, Sean, some interesting comments. Let's wrap it up with any other maybe stocks that you like that you could share with us. You've already shared a couple, but is there anything else on your radar that you'd like to outline here?
Well, I will be speaking at the Orlando Money Show next week on February 6th, and I'm actually running the cannabis track. So I'll be introducing people talking about cannabis all day long. So I'll share one of the picks that I'll be bringing there, and that's a company called Arcadia Biosciences, symbol RKDA in the U.S. And what's interesting about that is they genetically engineer hemp seeds. And one of the problems with growing hemp, as many hemp finders are discovering, is that hemp can become too hot. That's not temperature-wise. What that means is it has too much THC content in it. A large portion of the hemp grown in Arizona just had to be destroyed because it was too hot. It had too much THC. The seeds from Arcadia fix that. Because they are genetically designed, they only have a certain amount of THC, very, very little. And so if you're a hemp farmer, you want their seeds. Arcadia just announced their new sales numbers, and they were extraordinarily good. I think everybody's going to want their seeds. Now, this isn't cannabis, it's hemp, and I'm sure anybody who's interested in that market knows the difference. But I think that the way that cannabis stocks in general, we can also talk about hemp stocks, have been beaten down in the past year and a half. Has just been, brutal. Some were beaten down for very good reasons, but a lot of babies were thrown out with the bathwater. And I think that you can find some extraordinary values in the cannabis space right now. And RKBA, which is Arcadia Biosciences, that's one that I think people should look at. And that's one I'll be speaking about when I speak at the Orlando Money Show on February 6th. And so what you have to look at is, I think, buying the indices. There's more than a few cannabis-focused ETFs right now. That's really not the way to go. But individual names can do very, very well. One more sign of a bottom in cannabis is two pot ETFs up in Canada just shot down. That's not the thing you see happen at a market top. That's the thing you see happen at a market bottom. And so for sentiment reasons, fundamental reasons, whatever you want to look at, I think people should look at those companies which might not be turning a profit now, but are close to turning a profit and have a clear runway to turning a profit. In that industry, I think they can do extraordinarily well.
All right, Sean, we're going to wrap it up there. I do appreciate all of your comments, and I look forward to chatting with you in another couple weeks. Everybody stick around. I'm going to be right back with an update from Great Bear Resources. Thanks for your time, Sean. All right, here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. As promised, we have an update from Great Bear Resources and the president and CEO, Chris Taylor. Now, Chris, we're going to give a little bit more insight into a news release that came out just yesterday, January 31st, that outlines the proposed spin-out of a 2% NSR, so net smelter royalty, on the Dixie Project to create Great Bear Royalties Corp. You and I talked about this opportunity or this NSR when it was first announced a few months ago, but now that we have a few more details, please take us through the overall strategy of what the company is planning to do now with this spin out Great Bear Royalties Corp.
Okay, Corey. Well, some of the most profitable companies in the mining space don't actually mine ore out of the ground. These are actually royalty companies, which have a little bit of the economic stream of benefit that comes off of a number of deposits around the world. So I think the biggest one that people will be familiar with is, say, Franco, Nevada. You know, this is a multi-billion dollar entity, and there's an appeal for these royalty companies because they have very low overhead. So it's an example, you know, of a company that can have a multi-billion dollar market cap and yet, you know, be run by a small handful of people. So we obviously been involved in the mining space for a long time in the Discovery Group. We have some very experienced people that have been involved in multiple projects. Some of them have owned royalty streams in the past. And just as we began seeing the scope of the gold system that's developing at the Dixie Project, it was becoming evident to us that this project has the potential to be the biggest one that any of us have worked with in terms of a gold discovery. So obviously that's in progress now. We're doing all the drilling that we're doing. We have this $21 million exploration program this year, which is 2020. So very, very busy, but also very attractive early stage results. So we thought, well, if the project ends up evolving and looking as attractive as we think it could, there aren't any projects beyond a certain size threshold that are actually operated by independent junior companies like Great Bear. These projects, once they get to a certain threshold, will always, almost in every case, be bought by big major producers. And obviously, you end up in a situation where you're growing something and it just keeps generating good results and it keeps getting bigger and it keeps getting more appealing. This is what's happening at Dixie with us now. And yet we're looking at an asset that we might lose control of over the long term. But I look at Great Bear and, you know, in my case, it's been over 10 years of involvement with the company now. I was 2010 when I got involved as the vice president of exploration initially. And here we are in 2020 and I'm the president and CEO. So a decade of effort into growing everything into the point it is now. And at some point, we just acknowledge we're being pragmatic about the whole thing, that if it keeps generating good results and it keeps growing the way it has been, we might not control every aspect of the project or it might get bought from us at some point. So by putting the royalty on it as we're doing, this 2% net smelter royalty, we should be able to protect the value or portion of the future value of the project for our shareholders. And I'm a shareholder of the company. The other board members and advisors of the company are all significant shareholders of the company. So, and all these, all the people that believed in the story at an early stage and gave us money and let us develop and let us grow, we want to make sure that we're benefiting our shareholder base. The Great Bear shareholder base is going to, through this royalty, should the project develop into a big successful mine, we will have exposure to some of the economic benefits from that big mine in the future if it all keeps going so well.
Okay, Chris, so I want you to comment on one part. Early on in the news release, it does say that Great Bear Royalties will not initially be listed on a public stock exchange, but will operate as a reporting issuer. Great Bear Royalties will evaluate all strategic opportunities available to the company to enhance value. What are some of these strategic opportunities that you see potentially increasing value?
There's a number of opportunities that could come our way. I think probably the simplest form of opportunity would be that, you know, for instance, if the project generates a lot of international interest, it ends up being acknowledged that it's a, you know, very significant gold discovery, the royalty will be worth a lot more in the future than it is now. Now, say you are a big royalty company, you're worth billions of dollars, and you're looking at generating, you're looking at purchasing additional royalties, because royalties, although the right may last forever, the cash flow from operations on mines never lasts forever. So you're always looking, like a mining company would be, for the next stream of exposure to more gold. And in that case, what we have at Dixie might be an asset that could be interesting as a purchase for one of these big companies. So a simple way that we could sort of monetize some of that value would be to sell the royalty or a portion of it to one of these big royalty companies. That could generate a you know, a nice capital event for shareholders of the Royalty Co. Other ways that you could get exposed to long-term valuation would be effectively building a royalty company based on that asset. And this is how other royalty companies, like the example I typically use because it's a Canadian example, is Osisko Royalties. And Osisko Royalties, one of the underlying royalties that they have is the Canadian Malartic mine. And I believe there's about a 5 to 7% royalty that they have on that mine. And that is generating a significant amount of cash flow for Osisko Royalties. And it's definitely been the basis of forming that company into, you know, a multi-billion dollar asset as it is today. So that's another way that you could get exposure, is you could build Great Bear Royalties up into a multi-asset royalty company, and that way it can grow organically over time. So those are probably the two most likely scenarios for how the valuation off the spin-out shares would be valuable to shareholders. And in terms of the potential value thereon, it depends. You know, if you have a single asset, and in the future, if the Dixie project is successful and it's a cash flowing, you know, mine, you know, you might be looking at something that has a very attractive valuation in terms of that 2% royalty. It could be similar to the value of Great Bear today. And that's something you can't get your head around at this early stage, but you recognize the opportunity. So it could be quite a valuable opportunity. So it seems like it's a very good idea from that perspective to at least give us the potential to walk through all these different types of prospective open doors.
Thank you for outlining a couple of those opportunities, because I know some people were looking at this spin out and saying, okay, well, this is just going to be another avenue for them to potentially sell this and bring in some more money or raise some more cash for the company. But hey, there is that opportunity of actually starting up a royalty company here and basing it on what could be a very profitable royalty. Let's get into the work that is happening now within Great Bear and the Dixie Project. Please give us a general update on the work that's occurring right now.
This is a good chance to talk about it too. We'll probably have a very fulsome update in the near future regarding where we've been drilling, what we've been drilling over the course of 2020 so far. As we've indicated with all the public releases up to date, I mean, we have an over $20 million exploration program going on right now. That'll consist of more than 110,000 meters of diamond drilling. So this is effectively, I believe, the second largest drill program in Canada, which makes it one of the largest exploration drill programs in the world. And what you'll see over the course of the year is a number of results coming out from Great Bear, a lot of results, like probably looking at our best guess at this point is somewhere between about 250 and 350 drill holes. It's a hell of a lot of drilling, you know. So we're generating now several hundred meters of drill core per day. At the moment, there's four rigs operating on the project. There'll be a fifth one on the project shortly. And that number will probably, you know, that'll be sustained over the course of the entire calendar year. So what we'd like to do over 2020, and this is probably the most important thing, is the number of eyes on Great Bear has increased by like an order of magnitude going into this year. And what we've been noticing is that, you know, I've fielded a large number of meetings with analysts, you know, corporate people, bankers, others, and all of them are taking the drill data that we've issued so far, and they're all trying to get their head around how many ounces of gold does Great Bear have in the ground and how many ounces could Great Bear have in the ground. Of course, this is something that we're doing at the same time, and this is something that's constantly being updated and informed with the drilling that's going on. So what you'll see in the news flow with Great Bear during 2020 is batches of results that are meaningful. And so far, you know, if you look at the drill results from 2017, 2018, and 2019, you'll see that this was very much an exploration-focused program that drilled a number of targets in a number of areas around the project. And the results as they came into the market were more or less in a random order. You had some gold over here, some gold over there, step outs in this region, some infill in that region, step downs over there. What you'll see in 2020 for news flow is when we put out results, there'll be multiple drill holes per drill section, especially as we step into areas along this big multi-kilometer LP fault target that we're drilling. And what it should allow the people that are interested in the company to do is really have a very good feeling for the mineralized volumes, how the gold is hanging together, and it'll show that kind of continuity. It'll show the size, and it'll show really the scale and the prospects of the project in a definitive way. So less of a random walk approach, more of an orderly distribution of results. And of course, we're still doing stepping out and testing various targets across the project. As I've said many times, about 20% of the targets have been drilled to date. About 80% of them have not been drilled. And it's been a very busy, even just inside of January of this year, we've been very busy. And those drills have been testing a number of new areas. So I think when you see the news flow, you'll see comprehensive results and people will have a very good idea what we're up to and what it means for the future of the company.
All right. I appreciate the update there, Chris. It sounds like another busy year for Great Bear, but in all fairness, we knew that just coming into this year with all the work that was planned. Very interesting to hear how you're going to tie it all together in terms of the, well, news releases and coming out with batch drill results. If anybody has any follow-up questions for Chris and his team over at Great Bear, please email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I will happily get those answered for you. Chris, appreciate you joining me on this weekend show. Everybody, I hope you have a great weekend. Anybody watching the Super Bowl? Yes, I am a Niners fan, so go Niners. Chris, thanks for your time this weekend.
Thanks very much, Corey. Talk to you again soon.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.